Hello, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of Memo's Weekly Review with me, Naseem Ahmed, and our regular guest, Moin Rabbani. Hi, Moin. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you again, Naseem, and thanks for having me.
So as usual, we'll be analyzing key events from Palestine, the wider region, and elsewhere, beginning with Gaza, discovery of another mass grave. News also from Palestine that Hamas is ready to dissolve its military wing if the Palestinian state is recognized on 1967 borders, implications of that. There's growing anxiety within Netanyahu's office of a possible ICC arrest warrant for the Israeli prime minister, which is a recent development. And from the region, so we'll be talking about the US veto at the UN, sanctions against Israeli military units, and also Israel's response to the Iranian drone strikes from last week. But let's begin, Moin, with the latest news from today, which is that following nearly now 3 months of investigation, the United Nations has a report has found that there is no evidence of UNRWA staff taking part in the October 7 attack. And let's talk, you know, begin with that and move on. So it's been 3 months, and the investigation was carried out by a French, former French minister, Catherine Colonna. So the review makes clear that UNRWA is indispensable to the Palestinians across the region, and there is no evidence of its members taking part in the attack, as I mentioned. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think this is a significant development, and I think it also says a lot about how UNRWA's Western donors have conducted themselves in recent months. Just to recap, in late January, immediately after the International Court of Justice issued its provisional measures on the basis that South Africa had plausibly accused Israel of genocide, Israel came out with allegations that I believe it was 12 UNRWA staff members were directly involved in the Hamas attacks of October 7th. 12 staff members out of something like 30,000. Immediately, the United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, and a number of other European and Western governments suspended their contributions to UNRWA at a time when it was the most important humanitarian agency operating in the Gaza Strip, and immediately after the International Court of Justice had emphasized the importance of humanitarian aid given the urgency of the crisis in the Gaza Strip. So arguably, their severance of funding was a direct violation of the court's provisional measures, which are binding not only on Israel, but on all signatories to the Genocide Convention. It quickly became evident that this was essentially a propaganda exercise. Israel came up with additional allegations that hundreds, perhaps thousands of UNRWA staff are either members of Hamas or have family members that are members of Hamas, as if that's a criminal charge. There was really not much substance to these allegations. And when people began pressing Israel for evidence to substantiate its allegations, it said it wasn't going to share them with UNRWA because, as far as Israel is concerned, UNRWA is a front organization. The larger background to this is the concerted campaign by Israel over a number of years to eliminate the organization because it sees it as a surrogate for the persistence of the Palestinian refugee question. And of course, the United States has been largely on board with this campaign. The United Nations responded by mobilizing this investigation that we're now discussing. It was chaired, as you mentioned, by the former French foreign minister, Catherine Colonna, assisted by a number of Scandinavian research organizations. And today they've published their report. They didn't say that they disagreed with Israel's evidence. Rather, they made the point that Israel did not provide any evidence for them to assess and evaluate. In other words, this entire issue has been a charade, has been a hoax from beginning to end. And in fact, we already knew this was the case for those who had any doubt several weeks ago when, excuse me, a number of Western governments and the European Union began resuming their funding of UNRWA, something that, of course, they would never in a million years have done if they had the slightest doubt that there were that these allegations were serious. And so, this whole thing is a concocted story done with the premeditated agenda of damaging, if not terminating, UNRWA. Israel's Western sponsors, as they always do, played along and went out of their way to intensify the humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. But in the end, it became too embarrassing even for them. The exceptions, of course, are the United Kingdom, which has yet to resume its funding, and the United States, where Congress, in exchange for agreeing to the Biden administration's request for an additional $26 billion for Israel, did so only on the condition that there would be no further U.S. funding of UNRWA until at least 2025. From Israel's perspective, a win-win situation, one might say. So the most important conclusion of the report is that Israel hasn't provided any evidence, and one can safely assume it hasn't provided any evidence because there is no evidence. Secondly, I should also add, that even if Israel was able to substantiate these allegations, we're talking about 12 out of 30,000 plus employees, and there was never any suggestion that UNRWA either had knowledge of their alleged participation or was in any way institutionally involved in these events. Secondly, the report emphasizes the critical importance of UNRWA in providing urgently needed humanitarian assistance to Palestinian refugees generally, and in the Gaza Strip particularly. And then it also looked at what has become the European Union's favorite pastime in recent decades, which is the interminable examination of the Palestinian school curriculum that is used by UNRWA. And it found that, for example, the main source of all the allegations in this respect are by a right-wing Israeli NGO, and that many of their complaints and allegations actually are about textbooks that are not even used by UNRWA in its curriculum. So it's an interesting report, also because perhaps one of its most interesting conclusions is that it looked at the issue of neutrality, because kind of the overarching theme of this report was how UNRWA can maintain its obligation for neutrality and impartiality, which is a core function and value of many such organizations. And it concluded that, in fact, UNRWA has more and better safeguards than most other organizations that conduct similar work. But again, as with so many of these humanitarian issues, the underlying purpose of this campaign is political, where UNRWA is the visible surrogate for the persistence of the Palestinian refugee question. And there's this idea among Israel and its flunkies that if they can eliminate UNRWA, they can somehow eliminate the Palestinian refugee question. And to that extent, I think this report represents a major and arguably profound setback to their agenda.
I think another reason why I think this was entirely political is the entrenched cultural and structural racism that exist in the way many Western nations view this conflict. Everything the Israelis say, they take it as being true until it's proven otherwise.
Yes.
And everything which disproves the Israeli narrative is seen as false until it's proven otherwise. And we see this time after time after time, whether it be the attack on the hospitals, and in this case, UNRWA. It's the Israelis who are believed, even though they, for example, concocted, concocted the story of Shireen Abu Akleh and many other cases, which have turned out to be entirely false. So, despite all those evidences, there's a tendency to automatically to believe the Israeli narrative and act upon that, and not believe the counter narrative until there's evidence otherwise. So I just find that completely disingenuous, and I think it shows the underlying racism that exists. And also, moving forward, do you think this will be used, the fact that Israel and its allies have marginalized UNRWA at a time Palestinians needed UNRWA more than anything else, as evidence that Israel was really intending to shut down food, cut off food, water, and humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians in Gaza? That would be another evidence of genocidal intent, wouldn't it?
Yes, I suspect it would, and that was clearly another part of Israel's agenda, is to strangle the most important aid organization working in the Gaza Strip at a time when Israeli leaders were openly announcing their intention to place the entire population of the Gaza Strip under siege. Regarding your point, I think it's perfectly accurate. Israel has a record of systematically lying and obfuscating the truth about it, not only its own actions, but also the actions of others. And as you said, in this case, whenever Israel makes an allegation against anyone, and despite its known record for systematic prevarication, Israel is assumed to be telling the truth until proven otherwise, exactly as you said. But in this case, the speed with which these Western governments cut off funding to UNRWA, again, on the supposition that a dozen out of 30,000 employees had been involved in attacks, and absolutely no allegation that the organization itself knew about or supported them in doing so. I suspect that when the archives are unsealed, we're very likely to find out that these governments knew from the very outset that these allegations were bogus. And of course, you had US Secretary of State Antony Blinken immediately coming out saying he hasn't seen the evidence, but he considers the allegations to be highly credible and all the rest of it. Exactly what one would expect of him and his government. But again, it seems to me we're talking about governments here that have quite competent intelligence agencies, and surely they must have been informed almost immediately that this is a propaganda exercise rather than a serious allegation. Yet they cut off funding before any investigation had begun. They didn't wait for the jury to convene before executing the suspect, so to speak.
Yeah, let's move on to our next story, which is the grisly discovery of another mass grave in Gaza. 200 bodies were found in Khan Yunus. But you wouldn't know that if you're watching basically the mainstream news. That I've not seen a single mainstream news agency cover this topic. It's such a horrific and shocking discovery. They seem to be more concerned about what's happening in Columbia University, and here in the UK, another fake anti-Semitism crisis following the march. But the two things for me here, which I want to ask you about, I mean, it seems like these are the kind of reasons to cover this, is why Israel has not still permitted any international journalists to enter Gaza. And also, I suspect, given there are thousands and thousands of Palestinians who have basically, there's no record of where they are at the moment. They're probably dead under the rubble. So we could most likely see more and more mass burial sites being discovered in the coming months as well.
Yes, I mean, I have to say the exact details remain unclear. Palestinian journalists who have been doing exceptional work under exceptionally difficult circumstances for over half a year now have revealed the existence of multiple graves just outside Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, very similar to what we saw in Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City when Israeli forces withdrew from there some time ago. And they have found bodies of patients, of civilians, of medical workers, some who were clearly summarily executed with their wrists tied with Ziploc handcuffs and so on. And so it seems quite clear that a massacre of some sort has taken place. And you know, I recently met with a foreign doctor who had worked in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, I believe, in January. And I asked him, you know, besides the obvious reasons of seeking to destroy Gaza's civilian infrastructure, why Israel seemed to be prioritizing the destruction of hospitals. And he gave a very interesting response, which was that in any society, hospitals represent, if you will, the last hope that people have. It's a place where they can go for treatment if they're ill. It's a place where they can go for refuge when they're threatened. It's a place that has professionals who are dedicated to the care of the sick and wounded and so on. And when you systematically eliminate that, what you're really targeting is not only the physical building and those who work in it, but you are eliminating the hope that a society has that it can continue to function as a society. And I thought that that was a very telling observation. And I think that also explains why we're seeing doctors and nurses and patients and so on among the dead and now at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. You raised the issue of foreign journalists, and without taking anything away, once again, from the exceptional work that Palestinian journalists, so many of whom have been killed, the work that they're doing under exceptionally difficult circumstances, you know, it needs to be emphasized, in my view, in every single news report about Gaza by every mainstream news organization. They should lead every report with a reminder that their reporters are being prevented by Israel from reporting directly from the scene by Israel. You know, that may generate some pressure on Israel to relax its prohibitions, and if it doesn't, it will at least raise awareness of how Israel is seeking to systematically conceal its conduct and the results of its savagery from the global audience.
And the reason I pose the question that is because, yes, Palestinian journalists are doing amazing work. but their coverage is only limited to Al Jazeera, TRT. They're not what many would consider mainstream. But if you had a CNN journalist and a Sky journalist there on the ground, it'd be very difficult to contest, when they show discover grave sites, and the narrative would be slightly different. And I think with that in mind, the Israelis have prevented foreign journalists from entering into Gaza. Let's move to our third topic, which is we spoke about this a few weeks ago when I asked you about all the multilateral organizations have kind of moved into gear and what's left. And it seems like the ICC, International Court of Criminal Court, could be issuing arrest warrants. That's what the Israeli sources are saying. A number of Israeli sources, Netanyahu's office is apprehensive, and they held an emergency meeting at the Prime Minister's office about how to fend off a potential arrest warrant from the ICC. So it seems like, as the saying goes, the wheel of justice turns slowly, but it does surely turn. So how much of a game changer do you think it would be to see arrest warrants being issued by the ICC against Benjamin Netanyahu or, for example, members of the IDF?
Yes, I mean the wheels of justice do turn slowly. Sometimes they move forward, sometimes actually they move backward. And in this case, I have to admit I'm rather skeptical of these press reports that the ICC is on the verge of indicting Israeli leadership figures. You know, the International Criminal Court, whose mandate really is personal criminal liability for violations of the Rome Statute, has been dragging its feet on what it calls the situation in Palestine for over a decade now. And none have dragged their feet more than the current prosecutor, Karim Khan of Great Britain, who made clear from the very outset that he had no intention of taking this file seriously. And when he did, when he his hand was forced by developments in the region, he went out of his way to focus on Palestinian atrocities to the extent that Palestinian human rights organizations, who had repeatedly been seeking a meeting with him but were being rebuffed, refused to meet with him when he came to Ramallah, not because they felt that Palestinian crimes should not be investigated, but because they felt that all crimes should be investigated. And you know, Khan has been absolutely silent for months now. Rumor has it he's still decorating his Christmas tree. And my sense of his agenda is that he will most likely focus on indicting Palestinian militants, you know, leaders of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. And then, for the sake of balance, throw in a few extremist settlers to show that he's being impartial and applying his mandate across the board. Whereas, of course, the main culprits in this entire equation are not, you know, the settlers who kill a Palestinian here and burn a village there. They're the political and military leaders who are responsible for the genocidal assault on the Gaza Strip that we've been discussing, who are responsible for a host of war crimes and crimes against humanity throughout the occupied territories, but who seem to consistently land in Karim Khan's blind spot. I'd be very pleasantly surprised if I'm proven wrong on this score. But I remain skeptical, and particularly also because if you look at the staff that Khan has appointed, you know, former British and a former American military investigators whose experience was basically oiling the machinery of occupation in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I'm not very optimistic on that score either. I'm certainly not going to hold my breath on this one. And perhaps Israel's agenda was no more than to raise the alarm and increase the pressure by its sponsors and allies on the court, just in case.
Your instinct may well be right here, because this is just based, I am going on what has been reported in Israeli sources,
Yes.
and I thought it was an interesting development. And you're right. I mean, this probably won't have much traction, especially because the US is so hostile to the ICC. I was looking into this, and it's so hostile to the extent that the US has an act called the American Service Members Protection Act, which
Also known
basically,
as the Hague Invasion Act.
yeah, that's right. Which I mean, do you want to explain that? When I looked into it, I found it quite comical how the US has granted permission to itself to do anything, whatever is necessary to bring about the release of any person indicted by the ICC. I just found it quite shocking, and I think, look, judging by the way the US has handled this situation, you could see the APEC-funded members of the Congress voting on expanding this to protecting Israeli officials. Why wouldn't they? Of course, I'm speculating, but that's a scenario which I can envisage given the level of hostility you see in Washington towards the ICC.
Yes, well, when the International Criminal Court came into being, I'm not entirely certain of the history here, but I believe the Clinton administration during its final days took initial steps to join this court, and that the George W. Bush administration then reversed that, and United States is not a member state of the International Criminal Court. Not only that, Congress passed legislation authorizing the US military to use force to extract any US official who was in the custody of the court, whose prison facilities, of course, are in The Hague, and that's why it's called the Hague Invasion Act. Israel, during initial discussions that led to the formation of the ICC, was actually a supporter of the idea. You know, it saw this as perhaps keeping alive the memory of the German Holocaust during the Second World War and so on. But then two things happened. First of all, the Rome Statute included apartheid as a crime against humanity. And secondly, it basically adopted language from the Fourth Geneva Convention about settlement building and expansion, you know, moving your own civilian population into occupied territory, which it defined as a war crime. And when a majority of ICC founding members adopted those and incorporated them into the Rome Statute, Israel came to the conclusion that, in fact, this court is anti-Semitic. It's this. It's, you know, all the usual nonsense. And Israel has been a very strong critic of the court. Of course, you know, U.S. opposition to the court didn't stop it from assisting the court in its investigations of Russian conduct in Ukraine during the past 2 years. And I think for the first time, the US has actually cooperated with the court and provided it with information that led to its very rapid indictments of Russian President Vladimir Putin. And that, I think, is another indication of why these reports are perhaps off the mark, because the court has been investigating the situation in Palestine now for a decade and has yet to give a serious sign of life. Whereas in the case of Ukraine, immediately amid much fanfare, it assembled a massive investigatory team. Khan was in Kiev virtually from the moment the first Russian soldier set foot in Ukraine. Within a year, he had indicted Putin and so on. Again, we'll find out sooner or later, but it doesn't seem to be serious.
One final question, sticking with Gaza. Hamas has said that it's ready to dissolve its military wing if a Palestinian state is recognized on the 1967 borders. So this news was announced after a meeting with Ismail Haniyeh and Turkish officials, I think, in Qatar. This, of course, wouldn't be the first time Hamas has said that it's open to a two-state solution. And if the two-state solution really was the goal, then I think Western countries should have realized that Hamas has conceded this many, many years ago, I think as far back as 2017. And Israel's the party which has constantly blocked any attempt to reach a two-state solution. But what do you make of this current and the late this latest announcement that they are ready to dissolve their military wing and in exchange for a two-state solution?
Well, it's a revelation to those who are unfamiliar with reality. As you mentioned, in 2017, Hamas, as an organization, formally adopted an endorsement of a two-state settlement. But individual senior Hamas leaders, including its founder and his successor, and a number of others, have over the years in interviews supported the idea of the establishment of an independent, sovereign Palestinian state in the territories occupied by Israel in 1967, and that if such a resolution was negotiated and properly endorsed by the Palestinians in either a national referendum or through what they termed legitimate national institutions, meaning a PLO that included Hamas in it rather than excluded, then Hamas would consider this a basis for what it calls a long-term truce, basically an indefinite, i.e., permanent cessation of hostilities. Hamas has always maintained that as a movement, it will not recognize Israel. And its basis for doing so, to me, appears quite sound, that recognition is a matter between states and formal authorities, not for individual political parties and movements. So, for example, if we go back to the exchanges of recognition in 1993 between Israel and the PLO in the context of the Oslo Accords, it was a PLO that recognized Israel. Even the Fatah movement, which formed the background of the PLO, did not recognize Israel. And to the best of my recollection, none of the major Israeli political parties recognized the PLO. Rather, it was the Israeli government that did so. And so this most recent statement is, for those familiar with this issue, really nothing new. And I think what Hamas is basically saying is that if there were to be a independent sovereign Palestinian state in the context of a two-state settlement, that there would be no need for the movement to maintain a military wing independent of the formal structures of that state.
And I mean, I said at the beginning, a two-state settlement is the official US position. But you have to ask if that really is the case, given what happened last week with the US vetoing a UN resolution, calling for Palestine to become a member state. Of course, the US has vetoed similar resolutions before. But I wonder, I mean, if you think, this time around, it was more counterproductive to veto the resolution. It was, many would say, an opportunity to leverage what is stated US policy to apply pressure on Israel. It could have used that vote to buy back some goodwill from the international community. US has been isolated in the international community, and reverse its isolation. And given the Palestinian state is a precondition for Saudis to sign into the Abraham Accords, it seemed a no-brainer to express this intention for a two-state settlement. So why would it veto this time around? It just seems so counterproductive.
Well, the reason it vetoes it is because the US is against Palestinian statehood. It is against Palestinian self-determination. At the verbal level, it proclaims its endorsement of a Palestinian state, but its actions have consistently, systematically, over the course of many decades, pointed in exactly the opposite direction. The US has never lost an opportunity to make Palestinians, to frustrate Palestinian statehood and to make the prospect of a Palestinian state ever more distant, either through its active support or passive acquiescence in Israeli policies to consolidate its rule over the territories that are supposed to form the Palestinian state, or through its opposition to any Palestinian initiative, including diplomacy, to bring that goal nearer. So, just in the past several months, we have had the United States twice voting against General Assembly resolutions reaffirming the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. And most recently, as you mentioned, the US once again proudly stood alone in the Security Council, opposing a draft resolution that would have endorsed Palestine's application to become a full member of the world body, and that would have referred that application for a majority vote in, or for a vote in the General Assembly, where it would easily have passed. So even the US's closest allies on the council, the UK, France, Japan, South Korea, and others, all of them voted for this resolution. The UK abstained, but all the others voted for. And it just shows how isolated the United States has become on the world stage due to its passionate attachment to any and every Israeli policy that has to do with frustrating the prospect of Palestinian statehood and self-determination. The US is not only isolated, it's really made itself into a laughing stock on the international stage through its refusal to see the region through anything but the vision of Israel's most extreme leaders.
No, I think it completely undermines the story US told about itself after the Second World War, which is that really the US acts in the interest of the world and not unlike any other superpower, which acted in the interest of itself. And that's been the story it's been telling everyone because it brought peace to Europe, peace to Japan, peace to all parts of the world, it would argue.
Well, if
But
your
that's.
world is Israel, you are acting on behalf of the world.
Yes, we will get to that. And a Republican official who said that, Jerusalem is the center of the world. I mean, that's a question I will have later on when we discuss what's happening in the US and Columbia University. But before we get to that, we spent a lot of time last week. I want to discuss the response of the Israelis to the Iranian attack. We spent, I think, the entire show last week talking about discussing the Iranian attack on Israel. So far, it seems Biden may have persuaded the Israelis not to escalate, and his efforts may have paid off. So it seems like when the Americans want to, they can exert pressure. We don't know at what cost. Do you think it's
Well,
too early to
the cost
tell?
was $26 billion, but go on.
Okay. So, I mean, So, do you think it's too early to tell? I mean, is the US, do you think behind the scene able to persuade the Israelis not to escalate, or are we going to see an escalation, a response on a grand scale, in the next weeks or months?
Well, I think there's two consistent strands in US policy since October 7th. The first is unqualified support for Israel, and the second is unqualified opposition to the expansion of the war in Gaza into a regional conflict. And in that context, Washington very early on sent several aircraft carriers to the Eastern Mediterranean, in its view, to deter Hezbollah from launching a full-scale conflict of its own with Israel. It launched Operation Prosperity Guardian in a largely failed effort to keep the Red Sea and the Suez Canal open for maritime commercial shipping. And most recently, in the wake of Israel's bombing of the Iranian diplomatic facility in Damascus, it worked overtime to try to prevent Iran from retaliating from that attack. Of course, it didn't work because the US, along with Britain and France, blocked the Security Council from condemning that attack. And Washington then basically laughed off an Iranian proposal that if Israel's genocidal assault on the Gaza Strip were to come to an end, Iran would not see a need to respond to the Israeli attack on its diplomatic facilities in Damascus. But, Iran did retaliate. I think there's an untold story there because we don't know to what extent the Iranians intended to cause significant damage on the Israeli military facilities they targeted, as opposed to sending a message to Israel and the United States about their capabilities and in order to basically put a limit on their escalation. And the minute that attack ended, or actually while it was still being conducted, the Iranians said they considered the matter concluded. Israel clearly saw things differently, and there are reports that it wanted to immediately launch a major attack of its own on Iran in response to the Iranian retaliation. And here it appears that, as you suggest, the Biden administration did intervene initially to try to persuade Israel to see limited damage caused by the Iranian attack as a victory and kind of call it a day. And later to persuade the Israelis to attack in a way that would not require an Iranian response. And this was quite tricky because the Iranians had initially announced that as of now, any Israeli attack, whether on Iran or any Iranian interests or officials outside Iran, would be met with an immediate and decisive Iranian response. What happened here is that Israel appears to have launched a few drones from within Iran and a few missiles from beyond Iran's airspace, apparently to send a message about their capabilities, but conducting only limited damage. This time, Israel did not take responsibility for these attacks. Iran chose to minimize them and not to directly blame Israel. And so the situation appears to have cooled down for the time being. There are two problems. The first is that a direct confrontation between the United States and Iran remains the primary item on Israel's wish list. And I think the Americans are aware of this, and that may help explain their interventions during the past week. The second is that all these regional developments, the escalations and so on, are all a direct function of the continuation of Israel's war on the Gaza Strip. In other words, so long as that campaign continues, the risks of renewed and expanded regional conflict not only continue to exist, but continue to expand and increase. And so we have to take account of the prospect that whether we're talking about Lebanon or Iran or elsewhere, that this really can blow up and develop into a full-scale regional conflict unless and until Israel's genocidal onslaught on the Gaza Strip is brought to an end.
Yeah, and it's, of course, while the genocide is taking place in Gaza, it has expanded into the West Bank. There's an ethnic cleansing going on in the West Bank right now.
Yes.
And I think the Americans have realized they have to do something about it, which is why Blinken has announced that it would be imposing sanctions on an Israeli battalion, the Netzer Yehuda battalion. That's basically a battalion that was created for religious fundamentalists, as they say. In Israel, and since its founding in 1999, more and more extremist settlers have joined that battalion. But how seriously should we take that? Because remember, the first round of sanctions against settlers, it wasn't really sanctions because when the banks closed the accounts of the settlers, Blinken intervened, said, no, we didn't mean close their banks, bank
Yes.
accounts down. It wasn't really a proper sanction. So what are we to make of this sanction on this religious extremist settler battalion that's carrying out ethnic cleansing in the West Bank?
Yes, I mean, the Israeli banks took these sanctions more seriously than the US government, which issued them. Look, in the larger scheme of things, it's clearly too little, too late. This has been going on for almost 6 decades, and it wasn't until 2024, after more than half a century of empowering Israel's occupation, of ensuring the impunity of its government and its military forces and so on to do as they please in the occupied territories, in this case, the West Bank, that the US finally began taking a few symbolic measures to demonstrate its displeasure with some of the most visible aspects of Israeli policy in the West Bank. If you're going to wait almost 6 decades to begin adopting such measures, I think the first observation to make is that it's most likely a situation of too little, too late. Secondly, these will have no real impact on the ground. They're not sanctions. Basically, it's conforming to U.S. law that, according to what's called the Leahy Law, the United States cannot give direct assistance to military units that are involved in grave or systematic abuses of human rights, nor can it conduct training exercise with them. But of course, Israel is free to, because US military aid to Israel, in contrast to aid to many other countries, comes without any strings attached, with zero conditions. It's unconditional. So Israel can still purchase weapons from the United States, with the billions of dollars it gets from the US every year, and give those to these units. It's unlikely to have any real impact on the ground. But, excuse me, one could make the argument that it is symbolically important, and particularly when it comes to the very weak-kneed Europeans. That when they see that Washington is taking such measures, they may feel emboldened to take similar measures themselves. So I think if you're looking at it from an Israeli perspective, it's very significant because they have enjoyed total impunity for almost 60 years. No one ever calls them to account. The more they violate, the more support they get. They commit genocide, and the West is involved in a long-standing in a standing ovation. After everything we've been discussing the past few weeks, they're getting $26 billion and vetoes at the Security Council. So if you look at it from Israel's perspective of systematic impunity and zero accountability, to suddenly have one of your prized battalions or brigades or whatever it is singled out for condemnation, if you will, by your chief sponsor, the United States, surely that must come as something of a shock. And that's why we've seen Israeli leaders from across the board, not just Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who I think are now once again denouncing the US for anti-Semitism or whatever it is, the term it is that they use these days, but also Netanyahu, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, Benny Gantz, and others. They have all been seeking to intervene with the US not to proceed with this designation. I think from their point of view, this is a crack in the foundation. It's an opening of a door, opening of potential opening of the floodgates. I think their alarm is misplaced. I think it's a primarily a situation of too little, too late, but let's see.
And I'm glad you touched on the mindset, because as the saying goes, if all you've ever known is privilege, equality sounds like oppression.
Yes,
That's what the
having to stand in line for the
yes.
bus or at the counter can be a very disconcerting experience if you always have the freedom to simply shove everyone out of the way and grab what you want.
And that's the mindset that's been fed over and over years, over the decades. So of course, there'd be alarm. And also, it's worth mentioning that this decision was only undertaken after the fact that U.S. Secretary of State Blinken was exposed as having been sitting on recommendations by officials in the State Department. So maybe he was going to sanction those battalions. Maybe he wasn't. But the point is, the reports of him sitting on a decision from, well, advice from his own experts was released way before the sanction. So maybe he was forced into it. Who knows?
Yes, it seems that within the State Department, that there were leaks to the press that, we have referred a number of Israeli military units to the Secretary of State for these measures, and he's basically acted as if they don't exist. Remember, this is the same Secretary of State who has on multiple occasions circumvented Congress to give Israel all the weapons it needs to intensify its genocide. This is the same Secretary of State who's been behind all the vetoes at the Security Council. Blinken, like his boss, Joe Biden, is absolutely besotted with Israel. For them, it's a state that can do no wrong, that has almost sacrosanct status. They have a deep personal, ideological, political commitment to Israel, and essentially will stop at nothing to enable it and its agenda. But in this case, yes, he was embarrassed by what appeared to be leaks from his staff. I should also add that according to those leaks, it was not just this unit that was recommended for these measures, but a number of others as well. And apparently, Blinken then has chosen this particular unit for these U.S. measures. It's in a sense, it's an easy target. It's primarily recruited among extremist, messianic, fanatic religious settlers. And people who are quite controversial, even within their own society. It's kind of low-hanging fruit. Whereas if the US was in any way serious about this issue, it would, of course, sanction the Israeli government and the Israeli state, which is the one that established these military units, which arms them, which gives them their marching orders, which never holds them accountable, because one reason that these types of units, whether in Israel or anywhere else, are eligible, if you will, for such measures, is because the national judiciary and judicial system has to be shown to be doing nothing to hold them to account. That's certainly been the case with Israel.
Talking about messianic, let's turn to the final question, or final issue I want to discuss with you, which is events in the US and also in the UK to some extent, where there's a moral panic over anti-Semitism, especially in Columbia University, where the president, I can't pronounce her name, Minhaj Shafik, she's been grilled at the in Congress. And I want to read out what one of the Congress members, Republican Congress members, said to Shafik in his line of questioning. He quoted Genesis 12:3, saying, where it says in the Bible, "I will bless those who bless you," you meaning Israel, "and whoever curses you, I will curse you, and all people on earth will be blessed through you," meaning Israel. So he's posing these questions to the president of Columbia University. And then, after quoting the Bible, he says, "Do you want Columbia University to be cursed by God?" And this is an exchange in Congress in a
Yes.
hearing. And it's so normalized that this kind of exchange is allowed to take place and no one questions it. I found it quite shocking.
Yes. And Minush Shafiq, in her desperation to pander to these people, took the question seriously instead of dismissing it, and responded, "Oh, of course not." You know, as if this was a serious line of inquiry deserving of a serious response. Her whole approach to this was to pander to the insatiable bullies. She genuinely appears to have believed it would work, making false statements about Columbia staff who were being removed from posts and investigated and whatnot, thinking that in contrast to her predecessors from Harvard and University of Pennsylvania, that she could save her skin by appeasing these insatiable lunatics. But of course, it didn't work because they're still calling for her dismissal. And now she has, I think, considerably fewer allies within the university itself, because of her shameful conduct in Congress and her shameful conduct towards her own students.
Yeah, and I think on a wider note, I mean, the question is still on how, going back to my previous point, which is that if all you've ever known is privilege, then equality sounds like oppression. And this is exactly what I had in what I thought when I saw the outrage against protesters in Columbia University and also here in the UK, where this agent provocateur from a pro-Israeli Zionist group tried to stir another moral panic about anti-Semitism here in the UK. But he's been actually exposed as an agent provocateur, let's just say. And to me, this is a further realization that the story and the narrative has become so extreme from the Israeli side, where you have Congress members quoting the Bible, where you have pro-Israeli agents, pro-Israeli supporters exposing themselves in a way which no one believes them. And I think this is another sign of the defeat, I think, of the Israeli
Yes.
narrative.
Yes. I mean, when you've lost the game, you try to get the referee to cheat on your behalf. And
Yeah.
that's exactly what's happening here. They can no longer persuasively present their case in the court of public opinion. They have lost the battle of ideas. So they're seeking to manipulate and distort the legal system in order to eliminate the opposition from the playing field, so to speak. It's the equivalent of giving every player who kicks a ball a red card for playing soccer. It's and of course it's painful, and sometimes it works, but ultimately, this resort to authority, this resort to legal institutions and so on, to me, is a sign above all of weakness and defeat. Because, if your propaganda was effective, if you were winning the battle for public opinion, you wouldn't need to undertake these kinds of measures, and you certainly wouldn't need to rely on these American ISIS types who threaten president of Columbia University with being cursed by God.
Yeah, and threaten the National Guards on to the streets of
Yes, that
America.
too.
That's another one. Okay, thank you, Moin. That wraps up another episode of our conversation. And thank you for tuning in, and see you next week for another episode of Memo Review with me, Nasim Ahmed. Bye-bye.